You're here with the Climate Justice Forum on KRFP Moscow. I'm your host, Helen Yost, and we have lots of great things happening tonight on our show. We're going to host Christian Owenray. She's a co-founder and leader of High Country Rising Tide in Wyoming. She's going to talk about recent protests and upcoming protests and a direct action camp this summer. It's in early August, focused on Powder River Basin coal mining and proposed coal exports to Asia. Also, she'll be on at 8 o'clock. At 8:30, Marty Cobinet, who's an organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network in Minnesota, is going to talk about some of the protests that have been going on among the Indigenous community in Canada and beyond against various tar sands infrastructure. And Marty was here in the region back in February 2011 when he helped co-organize a workshop against the megaloads before they started rolling down in Lewiston at the casino. And so before we talk a little more about what's going on with all kinds of things centered around tar sands, coal, and fracking in the region and beyond, this wonderful YouTube performance came about by some commentary from Derek Jensen, who was here in town and interviewed by myself a few years ago, as well as some other visionaries and performers, and I'd like to play that for you now. It's called Resist, Do Not Comply, and it is a call out to the climate movement, asking people to consider seriously their activism and what we're going to do about this terrible rampaging industrial juggernaut we've unleashed and is just getting worse over the last 10,000 years. So here we go. I am going to interrupt somewhere near the end for reasons I will explain later.
This culture is incompatible with life. It is systematically destroying the planet. Unless it's stopped, it will kill every living being.
This is a war. It may feel like daily life because it's been going on for 10,000 years, but it's a war.
Do you believe that our culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? I've asked that question hundreds of times and no one ever says yes. If we accept the seriousness of that answer, what does it mean for our strategy? Nobody knows because we never talk about it. We're too busy pretending the culture will undergo a magical transformation.
The task of an activist is not to navigate systems of power with as much personal integrity as possible. It's to dismantle those systems.
Do we stand by and watch the last of the salmon die? Do we write letters and file lawsuits that we know in our hearts will ultimately not make much difference? Do we take out the dams ourselves?
We need to start thinking like a serious resistance movement.
What would we do if space aliens were damming rivers we love and rely on? If they were cutting down forests we love and rely on, vacuuming oceans we love and rely on, changing the climate? Wouldn't stopping them become a series of straightforward, if perhaps daunting, tasks?
We need a movement that's brave and smart and militant and means it. We need warriors who will put themselves between what is left of our planet and fossil fuel. And if for any one of 1,000 legitimate reasons you can't be one of those warriors, it's fine. Then be part of a culture of resistance. Because a resistance movement always needs two things: loyalty and material support. Any of us can do that.
Are you hoping for a miracle? Am I still in your plans? No use hoping for a miracle. I am balanced in your hands.
wherever you choose to make your stand. Give me a threshold, a specific point at which you finally stop running, at which you finally fight back.
Let's head towards some local news and talk about some things that have been going on up in Spokane, actually. There was a big action last night. We called it the Washington-Idaho Megaload Resistance because it was the first time that Idaho and Washington residents got together on their own streets and pushed back against big oil. So that was a major development. So at about 11:30 p.m. last night, May 20th, a dozen activists from Occupy Spokane and Wild Idaho Rising Tide converged in Spokane, Washington, to protest megaloads of oversized equipment bound for Alberta tar sands operations from the Port of Pasco. ExxonMobil Imperial Oil has been using Highway 395, Interstate 90, and city streets in Spokane and Spokane Valley since mid-October to transport road-damaging shipments weighing up to 400,000 pounds and stretching over 200 feet long. Diverted in Idaho from their originally intended Highway 12 route by court challenges and from their alternative Highway 95 path by Moscow area protests, these pieces of a tar sands bitumen processing plant will expand Canadian carbon fuel extraction, American dependence on oil, and continental greenhouse gas emissions while reaping hefty profits for one of the wealthiest corporations on Earth. From the pedestrian walkway over East 3rd Avenue near South Regal Street, Spokane climate justice activists draped banners that said "No Dirty Energy," "Occupy 99%," and a few smaller protest signs that said "Climate Killers" and "Highway to Hell" and other statements. And if you'd like to see photos of this protest, they're up on the Wild Idaho Rising Tide Facebook page. While waiting for the megaload convoy's arrival, these protesters observed flaggers and warning signs posted along 3rd Avenue, support vehicles cruising the area, and up to six Spokane City Police cars parked near the demonstrators. And local activists in Spokane, whom a few of us here in Moscow joined last night, said this was the first time that police officers were on the scene for one of these demonstrations, and this was about the fifth demonstration of its kind up in Spokane over the last, well, since about May 6th. Between midnight and 1 a.m. on Monday, that was today, earlier today, four megaloads traversed 3rd Avenue, narrowly fitting under the pedestrian overpass bridge and between parked cars and activists holding protest signs lining both sides of 3rd Avenue. Convoys consisting of Washington State Trooper escorts, flagger vehicles, and pilot trucks displaying illuminated oversized load signs accompanied first a silver cylindrical module. We've never seen anything like this before. Two large blue trailer-like boxes. We've seen plenty of those. They're usually the heavier megaloads. And a frame structure full of pipes and parts all running through the middle of it. A protest later saw another megaload among a cluster of vehicles similarly leaving the interstate at the Altamont Street exit in Spokane. And, of course, these loads also get off at the Barker Street off-ramp in Spokane Valley. Recognizing the international impacts of these transports, citizens throughout the Northwest will continue to coordinate and organize demonstrations to oppose and impede tar sands megaload traffic, to prevent increasing carbon emissions causing global climate change, and to dissuade investors in such dirty energy schemes. The mostly foreign-owned corporations who have mined only 2 or 3% of the Alberta tar sands are advancing the second fastest rate of deforestation in the world as they consume more energy, mostly derived from natural gas, than tar sands fuels ultimately yield. Their largest industrial project on Earth pollutes exorbitant volumes of fresh water and deposits heavy metals, carcinogens, and oil across vast swaths of Canadian boreal forests and wetlands. Resident First Nations villages still practicing subsistence lifestyles suffer rare cancers and disproportionate amounts of death as the single greatest contributor of atmospheric carbon in North America bodes game over for the Earth's climate. So if you're interested in these upcoming expressions of First Amendment rights through these anti-megalode assemblies in the Spokane area, you are more than welcome to contact Occupy Spokane. That's a Facebook page. There's also one called Occupy Spokane Events, where we tend to post announcements of upcoming protests. We usually don't know about these until a few hours in advance, since there is no public notice about these loads coming through. Please also check the Wild Idaho Rising Tide Facebook page, and sometimes we also even put it up on the website with such short advance notice, so you can find out the location and times of these protests. I do need to add, though, last night could have been the last time that megalodes go from the Port of Pasco through Spokane, crossing Washington, Idaho, and Montana for the tar sands up in Alberta. We saw five out of what our scout from Tri-Cities, from Occupy Tri-Cities, says is only seven remaining megalodes at the port. So there could be perhaps only one more chance, folks, to get out there and protest megalodes in our region. There's supposed to be a second phase of megalodes coming through. There was going to be a second and third phase for this Curl Tar or Oil Sands project forwarded by Imperial Oil, who's a Canadian subsidiary of ExxonMobil. Now it's been condensed to second phase, and that could start this year with transportation of modules from Korea across the Pacific, up barges on the Snake and or Columbia, and then the Snake Rivers to either the Port of Pasco or Lewiston. So we're keeping an eye on that situation to see what comes next. But please stay abreast of the situation, as many of our laws and agencies and even our representatives have failed us. Sometimes our last recourse is to take to the streets, and we very much welcome your participation. You don't have to get arrested. We just need you to be there on the side of the road to stand up to these corporations that are essentially taking over our world. So I just want to throw in that there was also a similar protest, though not as large, not as accompanied by a police presence, since these protests are growing in Spokane. That happened on Wednesday, May 16th. There were no participants from Moscow. However, on that night, there were two or three megalo convoys that went through Spokane, and there were Spokane residents there to call them out. So this is ongoing. It looks like it's going to be every Sunday and Wednesday night. So your next opportunity is likely this Wednesday, May 24th, to head up to Spokane and be involved in these protests. And we typically meet downtown either at Wanderer's Tavern, 205 South Washington Street, or at the Pie Hole, which is in that same area of 2nd and Washington Street. So keep on top of it, and please accompany us in these protests. We definitely need more than just a handful of people standing up against all these terrible things happening. But there was good news on Wednesday, and that is that the governor of Vermont signed a statewide ban on fracking, and that happened at 4:30 p.m. Eastern Time on Wednesday. Governor Shumlin, I'm not sure how you say his name, he signed House Bill 464, making Vermont the first state in the nation to ban fracking. And we thought that was a little significant, in that the House bill here in Idaho that caused all kinds of problems in terms of forwarding some of the industry interests and you know, allowing fracking and all kinds of other sort of poisonous activities to go on here in Idaho is also called House Bill 464, and that passed back on March 23rd down in Boise. So I'd like to play you this clip. It's just a two-minute clip of the governor stating why this was such an important moment in our history as people fighting fracking. So here you go.
Listen, this is a big deal, and it's an important moment for Vermont. As we pursue fracking with irrational exuberance, injecting chemicals into the groundwater of America, it seems that we may have taken leave of our senses at times. There is going to be, very soon, in my kids and in the Twinfield students' here's lives, a shortage of clean water on this planet. Drinking water will be more valuable than oil and natural gas. One can survive. Human beings survived for thousands and thousands of years without oil and without natural gas. We have never known humanity or life on this planet to survive without clean water. In the Green Mountain State, we have a long tradition of protecting our natural resources and leaving this planet and this state hopefully better than the way we found it. You can look at the planet two ways, that we inherited it and can do what we wish with it, or that it is our responsibility to borrow it from our kids and our grandkids. In Vermont, we take the latter approach. We recognize that we're borrowing Vermont from our kids and our grandkids. This bill will ensure that we do not inject chemicals into groundwater in a desperate pursuit for energy. It's a big moment. I hope other states will follow us. The science on fracking is uncertain at best. Let the other states be the guinea pigs. Let the Green Mountain State preserve its clean water, its lakes, its rivers, and its quality of life. This is a job creator. This is a job creator. If we have the clean water, the clean lakes, the clean rivers, the green mountains that are preserved, we will win both economically and environmentally. And that's what this bill is about.
Pretty amazing to hear those words coming out of Governor's mouth. So there you have it. That happened on Wednesday. It has renewed our interest in perhaps bringing forward, with the help of our many allies, a statewide ban on fracking here in Idaho, as we're facing some of the first of that practice happening down in South Idaho in Payette and Washington counties. We are having extended conversations with our allies down in that neck of the woods, trying to figure out when the first fracking is going to happen. We invite you to protests that will likely happen when these events happen, so we can be on the ground in those places to defend our shared groundwater here in Idaho, where we depend on groundwater for 98% of our water. Granted, that's mostly agricultural uses, but nonetheless, we don't think one single drop of fracking fluid should go into Idaho's precious water. So let's see. We have a few minutes until our first guest calls in from Wyoming. Perhaps we should talk a little bit about an event that's coming up in August that she will likely talk about some more. And that is an action training camp called West by Northwest. And it's happening, let's see, August 2nd starts at 1 p.m. and it goes until August 10th at 4 p.m. And they wrote a very great explanation of why they are hosting this action camp that I'd like to read for you. They said, and this is High Country Rising Tide, and it's going to be Christian Owenry. I'm not exactly sure how you say her name as well, but she'll be with us here in about 5 minutes. They said the evidence that humankind is hurtling towards climate catastrophe is overwhelming. The decisions that keep us on this path toward destruction may come down from corporate boardrooms and Washington's back rooms, but this summer the struggle for climate justice is coming to the real epicenter of climate change, Wyoming, USA. Last year, at the behest of America's largest coal companies, the federal government made a quiet announcement that it would release an additional 750 million tons of Wyoming coal for mining and export to Asia. Even though companies like Arch Coal and Peabody already profit obscenely from their federally subsidized extraction of Wyoming coal, which accounts for 40% of domestic coal, their reckless greed has driven them to pursue these new developments in order to flood Asian economies with cheap, dirty coal. The scale of this project and the health and environmental consequences it promises are nearly unimaginable. Not only would burning this coal cause 1.5 billion more tons of CO2 to be released into our atmosphere, this coal would be burned in densely populated Asian nations where health and environmental protections are under construction. Think London during the Industrial Revolution, black skies and black lungs. In addition, the glut of cheap U.S. subsidized coal on the rapidly expanding Chinese economy guarantees a major setback to their burgeoning and innovative renewable energy programs and locks them into a cycle of increasing energy costs and dependence upon their Western colonies. Simultaneously, in America, these same coal corporations have been pushing for the development of new rail lines and massive shipping terminals to ensure that plenty of domestic communities can experience the illness, noise, pollution, and delays of coal development and transportation before it makes its way abroad. Given all the evidence, it's almost as if when NASA climate scientist James Hansen referred to the Canadian tar sands oil and its transportation through the Keystone XL pipeline as game over for the climate and our environment, the coal companies took that as a challenge. We can do worse, they said. Well, we, the people, can do better. This August, activists and concerned citizens from all over the Intermountain West, Pacific Northwest, and allied communities will be convening for West by Northwest, the first annual No Coal Exports Radical Change Camp. In the heart of the coal fields, we'll look over the chasm into the world's largest strip mines, gather stories from the communities at the heart of the battle, and learn the skills of resistance. Students, ranchers, and activists will take to the streets, or the mines, or the rails, to take back the power to determine our own future. At the end of the week, we'll be arranging transportation to the coal export action in Helena, Montana, to gather momentum for the rising tide of resistance we need to defend the West and the world. For more information, you can go to the website coalexportaction.org, and that's for the later action, not for this action camp. But if you would like to find more information about this, actually, you'll probably come up with the same thing I just read. It's on Facebook under West by Northwest. If you would like to help to make this camp happen, you can email, and I won't try to read it to you here on the air, but it's on that same Facebook page. And if you want to be there, you can follow High Country Rising Tide, one of our great Rising Tide allies, on Facebook. And click attending to get updates about registration soon. If you want to do more, make a donation through the Rising Tide North America website to help High Country Rising Tide bring impact communities and allies together for the first time around this issue. And if you're interested in bringing some more friends, you can also email an address on that Facebook site for materials to be a campus or community outreach coordinator. Now, another thing that's going on, actually more locally, is a similar direct action training camp, and that's going to be happening up in Spokane on June 8th and 9th. That's a Friday evening and all day Saturday. And as our work to confront rapidly disappearing tar sands megaloads in Spokane and looming coal export trains across the Idaho Panhandle continues, Kim Marks and Jasmine Flora of Portland Rising Tide and Bill Moyer of Backbone Campaign are offering a direct action training session for Inland Northwest activists on this weekend of Friday, June 8th and all day Saturday, June 9th. Co-sponsors the Backbone Campaign, Forest Ethics, and Wild Idaho Rising Tide are designing a website as we speak with event descriptions and registration opportunities. And that should be finalized tomorrow or the next day. Please plan on attending this important regional workshop to network and learn media skills, banner making, blockade expertise, and other creative skills and tactics. And news about this, like I said, will be posted soon, likely on the website and Facebook pages. It's going to be held at Salem Lutheran Church. That's at 1428 West Broadway in Spokane. It will run from 5 to 9 on Friday evening, June 8th. We'll be talking about the various issues at that time and just giving people a chance to roll into town. We're anticipating activists coming from Missoula, Sandpoint, Moscow, of course, Spokane, the Tri-Cities area, from all over. And then on Saturday, it'll run from about 8 or 9 until about 5 or 6. And so we got some word from one of the trainers over the weekend about the kind of things they're going to cover. First, for the first 4 hours on Saturday, there will be nonviolent direct action training that will cover what is direct action, where does it happen. This training goes over the basics of how to use direct action effectively and strategically. Skills covered include forming affinity groups, de-escalation, and conflict management. That's, of course, with the cops and perhaps with each other, consensus, legal concerns, strategic action planning. This training will provide an introduction to pulling off direct actions, a history of the direct action movement, how to work as a group in a direct action context, action preparation and roles, and features many interactive role plays based on real life scenarios. This training provides an introduction to the movement and access points for activists to create working relationships. This training can be adapted according to the needs and experience of the group. And then I'm imagining after lunch, which lunch, of course, will also be provided, there'll be a three-hour action planning and blockades, looking at the big picture, strategy, tactics, setting goals, objectives, choosing targets, etc. This workshop goes over the basics of how to build the campaign you need to create change. It will cover planning campaigns to be more cohesive, effective, and strategic steps needed to implement an effective campaign, identifying your targets, building a network of strategic alliances, and how to coherently evaluate what's working and not working in existing campaigns. This training discusses the use of hard and soft blockades as an action tactic, learn strategy and techniques used to stop people and vehicles from accessing areas in the wilderness or in urban landscapes, blocking roads, taking over an intersection, or just trying to get out of the authorities' reaches. This training is hands-on and will include how to work with the materials such as ULOCs, black bears, and straight boxes, as well as methods of soft blockades using your body. This training can be adapted to include thorough training of building and using tripods, which adds an additional hour to the training. And then in addition to these trainings, mostly offered by the Portland Rising Tide folks, Bill Moyer is going to offer various sort of media and banner making and creative prop training. I understand we're probably going to make a banner on site, and that will likely happen outside. But again, this is going to be on June 8th, which is a Friday, and June 9th, all day Saturday, at the Salem Lutheran Church in Spokane, 1428 West Broadway. We have arranged places for people coming from out of town to stay in houses, also camping areas, likely out in Riverside State Park. It's your option, however you want to bed down for the night on Friday night. And then, of course, folks that are coming any distance might want to stay Saturday night as well and enjoy a concluding dinner and just folks getting together to talk. So that's another piece of things that are going on here locally. And then also, there's quite a few other events that we're involved in as an organization. We are continuing, of course, protests in Spokane. Perhaps also if there's a second phase at the Port of Pasco and Wallace. There were 5 loads that came through this last night, so there's likely going to be more in the future as ExxonMobil slid through Spokane so easily. Oh, and I do need to interrupt, but let time get away from me. You're listening to KRFP Moscow. This is the Climate Justice Forum program hosted by Wild Idaho Rising Tide, and I'm your host, Helen Yost. Also, some of the things we're working on through the collective of Wild Idaho Rising Tide is a community bill of rights at the county level. However, now we're starting to think we want a statewide initiative banning fracking. As I mentioned earlier, we are always open to local and distant guests on this radio program. We hope that you might consider even being a co-DJ. And, of course, Wild Idaho Rising Tide is still seeking adoption of our organization as a something that puts together this show and takes a lot of time and effort every week, and it also supports KRFP, which is a great volunteer radio program. So if you'd like to adopt Wild Idaho Rising Tide, please go to the KRFP website, go to Adopt a DJ, and there's a whole page that tells you how that works. It's only $10 a month, and it goes, or I think it might even be $20 now. It's one of the two, sorry. And it goes towards this great radio station. We're also putting on a road show. We already have plans to show The Tipping Point, which is a tar sands movie, in the Tri-Cities area in Kennewick at the library on June 1st. We're lining things up for next week as well in other towns like Kellogg and Coeur d'Alene and Spokane. We'll let you know some more about that next week. And then, of course, also... There is the Earth First Cascadia Bioregional Rendezvous going on near Portland. We'll be giving a workshop about the whole Megalo campaign and surrounding issues at that camp. It runs June 20th to 25th. And I'm sure if you just look for the website about the Earth First Cascadia Bioregional Rendezvous, you'll find some more information about where that's going to be located. That'll be coming out soon. On August 4th, we are going to be joining with folks all over the continent in the third annual Tar Sands Healing Walk at Fort McMurray. This is led by elders of the indigenous communities up around the Fort McMurray area who have been hardest hit by tar sands development, and we will be following their guidance in this walking prayer. We hope you'll join us. There'll be carpools leaving from Idaho, and of course we'll provide more information about that as the time gets closer, but that's August 4th. We'll likely be leaving on Wednesday, August 1st for that action. And then, of course, there's Action Camp hosted by High Country Rising Tide on August 2nd through the 10th, followed by the Coal Export Action, which you can also look up on the internet at the Montana Capitol in Helena. And so there's quite a bit of activity going on this summer. There's also another one I'll have to tell you probably about next week that's happening in mid-June down in southwestern Colorado. I can never remember the name of it, but essentially it's another action camp that's put on by those folks down there, and it's up to about year 3 or 4, but we'll bring some more news to you about that soon. And let's see, some of the things that are going on are here locally. Of course, there's been a lot of argument back and forth about whether the Megalode protesters, not per se Wild Idaho Rising Tide or any individuals involved, deserved recognition as Earth Protectors that was conferred by our Mayor Nancy Cheney here in Moscow back during Earth Week on April 16th. In response to an article that one gentleman put forward that said that we were hypocrites because we use oil products by standing up to big oil and saying that we don't want the tar sands to happen, especially by using our roads and they're bringing our equipment or their equipment through Idaho. A person that lives in Pullman called Peter Adrian wrote a letter on May 16th to the editor of the Moscow Pullman Daily News. His letter to the editor was entitled Wisdom, Not Hypocrisy. And he said, this is a very wise but brief piece, tucked in among the political endorsements on Thursday's editorial page on May 10th was a tart bit of criticism from Frank Luzzo, accusing, it is presumed, the Megalo protesters and those who support them of hypocrisy. I beg to differ. It is not hypocrisy to realize that an energy extraction process which requires more energy input than it returns as output is unsustainable, that allowing one's community to be used as a doormat for corporate profiteering is ultimately destructive to that community, that the growth-obsessed, consumption-driven economy in which we grew up has brought us to the brink of ecological catastrophe, that the extent of our benefit from the era of cheap oil should be the measure of our responsibility for leading the transition away from it, and that we, as a society, have been headed the wrong way, and it is time to change course. That is hypocrisy, or that is not hypocrisy. It is wisdom. So we thank Mr. Adrian for his input on that. And I, for one, was stunned that members of our community are so wise to understand the motivations behind our actions, even if they might not have been directly involved in them. So thank you very much for that. And then some other things that we're working on, of course, is that every Saturday we are, as Wild Idaho Rising Tide, at the Moscow Farmers Market. We reach out to our community every Saturday between 8 a.m. and 1 p.m. We started this on Saturday, well, not Saturday, May 5th, because we were actually at the Moscow Renaissance Fair, but every week since then. And that occurs in Friendship Square. So we're seeking volunteers to staff our booth in the nonprofit section and provide information and present opportunities for involvement in our many dirty energy resistance activities. You can contact Wild Otter Rising Tide by phone or email, and that contact information is available both on our website and on our Facebook page. If you would like to assist with this crucial outreach project this Saturday and or any other weekend leading up until about Halloween or the beginning of November. So we definitely would welcome your input for that. So I'm starting to assume that our colleagues with High Country Rising Tide have overlooked the fact that they were joining us tonight, but we'll try again perhaps next week. And I would like to say that we have contacted Vermont Public Interest Research Group, VPIRG. They were some of the main push behind getting that statewide fracking ban to happen in Vermont. We've invited them to be on this program as well. So perhaps that could happen next week. We'll see what how they respond. But for now, let's go back briefly, although not too briefly. There's a great article that was written by Senator Bernie Sanders and Governor Peter Shumlin of Vermont explaining title of their article is Vermont is Helping to Lead the Nation in Transforming Our Energy System. And they said, we come from Vermont. We know our small state cannot reverse global warming on its own, but we can provide a model for America which helps lead our nation and the world to a more sustainable and secure energy future. We see three major imperatives. First, we must act to reverse global warming. The scientific consensus is clear that global warming is real, that it is caused by human activities, and that it will only get worse if we do not take bold efforts now. At a time when many members of Congress do not even acknowledge that global warming is happening, in Vermont we are taking action. Vermont has more than 100 grassroots, citizen-led town energy committees that are working with state agencies to transform our energy system away from fossil fuels and into energy efficiency and such clean sources as sustainable energy as solar, geothermal, biomass, and wind. I beg to differ with the geothermal and the biomass in some ways. But anyway, second, at a time when our nation is trying to recover from the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression, we must seize the opportunity of creating millions of new jobs by making our homes, buildings, and appliances more energy efficient. We must also invest heavily in public transportation and rebuilding our rail system. Further, there are enormous economic opportunities not only in the installation of wind and solar projects, but in building these products here in the United States, not China. We are proud that according to a recent U.S. Labor Department estimate, Vermont leads the nation in green jobs per capita. That's one reason Vermont's unemployment rate is among the lowest in the nation. From the well drillers who now see the installation of geothermal heat pumps as a new opportunity to expand their businesses, to loggers in the woods who are helping to keep our schools and homes warm, to our innovative solar and wind companies that compete nationally and even internationally, our small state is home to a burgeoning network of new green businesses. This did not happen by accident. We have put in place policies that support green, clean technology businesses in Vermont. Finally, we must grasp opportunities to lower energy and fuel bills by moving away from foreign oil toward energy independence. We know this from firsthand experience. We live in a state where roughly half our homes are heated with oil. We live in a region of the country where electricity prices exceed the national average. Of the $1 billion spent every year to heat our homes and buildings in Vermont, 80% of that money goes out of state and in some cases to other nations that may not have our best interests in mind. By comparison, 80% of what we invest in energy efficiency stays in Vermont to purchase local goods and services and create jobs. The challenge is to turn these principles into practice. Upfront costs pose a steep barrier to homeowners and businesses converting to cleaner sources of energy or weatherizing homes and workplaces to make them more energy efficient. For an average working family, it's hard to come up with the $5,000 or $10,000 that might be needed to cut fuel bills by 25 to 50%. That's why we brought together energy providers, investors, and consumers at a first-of-its-kind clean energy investment summit. Vermont's efforts to move forward with innovative financing tools like on-bill financing and property-assessed clean energy will provide more households and businesses access to energy efficiency and sustainable energy technologies. We're already doing a lot of other things right. Our state is ranked number one by the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy in terms of energy efficiency policies. Our electric utilities sell less kilowatt hours of power than they did a few years ago, saving consumers tens of millions of dollars. We also have been a leader in weatherization for low-income families, with about 15,000 homes weatherized in the last decade. This saves energy and money about $916 per year per household. If every state over the next 10 years matched what Vermont accomplished over the last decade, our nation would need 390 fewer coal-burning plants, and American consumers would save $170 billion. Further, we will soon be the first state in the nation with near-universal smart meter coverage, opening the opportunity for more gains in energy efficiency. As we are making progress on sustainable energy, Major General Michael Duby of the Vermont National Guard recently discussed with considerable pride the 1.45 megawatt solar photovoltaic system, which the Guard recently installed. This project, one of the largest military solar installations in the nation, is not just good for the environment, it is saving the Guard an estimated $250,000 a year in energy costs. Further, in a state where so many buildings heat with oil, 47 Vermont schools are saving money and protecting the environment by heating with biomass harvested right here in New England. I wonder how their forests are doing. For the nation, like Vermont, moving forward aggressively in energy efficiency and sustainable energy is a win-win-win proposition. We protect our environment by cutting greenhouse gas emissions, we save homeowners and businesses money on their heating and cooling bills, and in the middle of a recession, we create jobs here at home, not in Saudi Arabia or Iran, although maybe we owe some of those places a little something, though we won't go into detail about that here. So let's see. There are some other things going on in Vermont that people might want to know about. And one of them is that same Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, he has put forward legislation into the U.S. Congress that would end more than $110 billion in fossil fuel subsidies. Stated in EcoWatch today, Senator Bernie Sanders, and that happened to be back on May 10th, and he is an independent senator from Vermont, and Representative Keith Ellison, who's a Democrat out of Minnesota, announced legislation that is by far the most comprehensive attempt to end subsidies for the fossil fuels industry in the U.S. Senator Sanders and Representative Ellison's bill would save taxpayers more than $10 billion a year and more than $110 billion over the next 10 years. Friends of the Earth tax analysis Ben Schreiber issued the following statement about the bill. Bold leadership like that which Senator Sanders and Representative Ellison have exhibited today will be necessary if we are to have any hope of avoiding climate catastrophe. We simply must stop paying corporations to cause asthma, lung disease, and cancer. Senator Sanders and Representative Ellison have gone far beyond anyone before them with the proposal to eliminate subsidies to the fossil fuel industry. Conservatively, we are giving more than $110 billion to fossil fuels, and the final tally is surely much higher. It is unconscionable that anyone is talking about cutting programs that make up the core of our social safety net, like Social Security and Medicaid, while we continue to give out billions of dollars each year to some of the world's largest and most profitable corporations, and ExxonMobil is surely one of those. Ending these subsidies is just common sense. The first step in responsible budgeting is ending incentives for pollution and instead making polluters pay for their pollution. So there, believe it or not, just as long as we're talking deep inside of the system here instead of out in the fringes with direct action. There's even a petition on Senator Bernie Sanders' own website. And he says, at a time when we have a record debt, Congress should not continue to give away taxpayer money to the fossil fuel industry. Fossil fuels are subsidized at nearly six times the rate of renewable energy. From 2002 to 2008, the U.S. government gave the mature fossil fuel industry over $72 billion in subsidies, while investments in the emerging renewable industry totaled only $12.2 billion. The fossil fuel energy industry does not need taxpayer subsidies. In 2011, the big five oil companies alone made $137 billion in profits. During the first quarter of 2012, the big five oil companies earned a combined $33.5 billion or $368 million per day. Unlike renewable energy incentives, which periodically expire and require Congress to approve extensions, the fossil fuel industry has dozens of subsidies permanently ingrained in the tax code from decades of successful lobbying. In 2011, the oil, gas, and coal industry spent a combined $167 million on lobbying the federal government. So if you want to, you know, sign this end, or, you know, if you want more information about the End Polluter Welfare Act, which is apparently Senator Sanders' bill, you can go to his website, and there's all kinds of great fact sheets as well as the full text of the bill, a list of current subsidies of all these different companies, and it looks like right now that the co-sponsors, as he's calling them, the petitioners of this petition, number about 15,000 people that have signed this. So check that out if you want more information about that bill. It's been tried a few times before to end these subsidies. I don't know how successful that's going to be, but we'll see what happens. So some other things that are going on is that the tar sands going through the Keystone XL pipeline is still, of course, sort of in a precarious situation. But Enbridge, the company that's proposing that pipeline, has proposed that they send their dirty tar sands oil another way. And so I guess on May 16th as well, last Wednesday, there was an announcement by Enbridge to increase tar sands imports to the U.S. I found this on the Natural Resource Defense Council's sort of switchboard blog site, and some of our allies out in the eastern part of the country, in Vermont and in Maine, have been fighting off these pipelines that are supposed to go, well, they already do go, except for in the opposite direction. They now go from the Maine coast out up to Montreal to carry oil in from ports in Maine, but this Enbridge is talking about reversing the flow in these pipelines and bringing tar sands oil out to the coast, presumably to be shipped to world markets. So let me read you a little about this, and I can tell you we have a dear fellow activist in Maine that we will also invite to be on this program to try to explain the situation for us a little further at some point. But this article states that Enbridge yesterday announced major expansion plans to its pipeline system that will increase the volume of risky and dirty tar sands flowing into the United States, across central Canada, and possibly even across New England. Significantly, Enbridge now plans to expand and double the capacity of the very same tar sands pipeline, and that's Line 6B, that burst in July 2010, causing the largest tar sands spill in the United States. And that was in Kalamazoo, Michigan. The expansion of this tar sands pipeline amounts to double jeopardy for the community of Marshall, Michigan, which has faced over 20 months of a prolonged and expensive cleanup of their local river, the Kalamazoo River. Enbridge's expansion plans also reveal they plan to ship tar sands through Ontario and Quebec to Montreal, a region that currently does not import tar sands. Bringing tar sands to Montreal also opens the door to importing tar sands to New England. Increasing the volume of tar sands coming into the United States deepens our troubling reliance on one of the dirtiest fuels on the planet. Tar sands, a thick, gooey, and heavy substance that is more toxic and corrosive than conventional oil, poses much greater risks than conventional oil. And it is very troubling that Enbridge's plans will introduce tar sands to parts of Canada and potentially parts of New England for the first time, bringing new risks to waterways, public health, and local economies. And apparently they have up on their site a fact sheet on the prospect of tar sands coming to central Canada and New England. They continue, late yesterday, Enbridge announced a series of projects, including expansions and reversals of several of its existing pipelines. And if you go to Oil Sands Truth, folks, you can see maps of the good dozen pipelines that already enmesh the upper tier of U.S. states. And there's also about a dozen tar sands refineries all across the northern states as well. But continuing, the plans include expanding several of its main tar sands pipelines, as well as pursuing pipeline reversals, enabling Enbridge to bring tar sands further east. Enbridge is not just importing more tar sands to parts of Canada and the United States. They are increasing the potential for more tar sand spills, which pose major threats to water supplies and the economy of local communities. For example, the expansion plans by Enbridge will enable them to double the capacity of a tar sands pipeline that spilled 1.2 million gallons of tar sands into the Kalamazoo River in Marshall, Michigan in 2010. The Kalamazoo River tar sand spill, the largest in U.S. history, has had a profound and negative impact on the nearby community of Marshall, Michigan, who has experienced health problems and negative economic impacts that continue to this day because the spill is not yet cleaned up. Tar sands oil is transported through pipelines as a heavier, more corrosive substance and contains more toxic chemicals and compounds than conventional crude. Tar sand spills inflict more damage than conventional oil and are far more difficult to clean up. Costs to clean up the Kalamazoo River have escalated to $750 million, 18 times as much per liter as conventional crude over the last 10 years. The cleanup of the Kalamazoo River spill, which has lasted almost 2 years, has been especially difficult because conventional oil response techniques have been ineffective, according to the EPA. While conventional oil floats on the surface, tar sands is thick and heavy and sinks in water, making it very difficult to clean up. Between 2007 and 2010, pipelines transporting tar sands oil in the northern Midwest have spilled three times more per mile than the U.S. national average for conventional crude. Enbridge's announcement is also significant in that it finally reveals their true plans to bring tar sands to Montreal, Quebec, where tar sands can easily be shipped southward into New England, revitalizing a plan first introduced in 2008 called Trailbreaker. Late last year, Enbridge sought regulatory approval to reverse a smaller portion of one of its pipelines to Ontario, Canada. Environmental groups in Canada and New England demanded that Enbridge come clean and share all of its expansion plans. The project was called Phase One, to learn about the true plans by Enbridge to ship tar sands eastward. In April, NRDC and several other groups sent in 40,000 comments to Canada's National Energy Board demanding that Enbridge come clean on its long-term plan to bring tar sands to the United States. Oh, it looks like we have our second guest with us. Hang on. Hi, Marty. Are you there?
Yeah.
All right. It's so good to have you here. So we're talking with Marty Cobinet. He has most recently worked with the Indigenous Environmental Network, and he is in Bemidji, Minnesota, one of the colder places in the United States. And Marty, can you give us a little more of an introduction about who you are and some of your work?
Some of my work, as you said, I've worked with IEN and fighting the Keystone XL pipeline. I've also fought the Alberta Clipper pipeline that went through northern Minnesota, and I've had the privilege of working with you guys out there and fighting the heavy haul. That's pretty much my resume.
All right. So we understand there has been numerous uprisings lately in the form of protests and other things of the Indigenous community across North America, having to deal with tar sands and other dirty energy projects. Can you fill us in a little bit about some of your most favorite protests that you've been hearing about or been involved with in terms of at least promoting or getting people involved in them lately?
Well, I think one of the bigger ones that's actually going to be happening tomorrow in London or in The Hague is during the Shell, basically stockholders meeting over there. There's going to be indigenous people there protesting and raising concerns. There's four indigenous people from the North Slope of Alaska down to the tar sands region and other places that are being affected by tar sands to tell Shell to get, or ask Shell to get out of the tar sands because of what they're doing there and in their oil exploration, not only in the tar sands, but also up in Alaska. So that's one of the cool things going on right now. Some of the other things that we've done is obviously, you know, working with different people across the United States down here is working with Deborah Wright Plume and those guys out in South Dakota. You know, they were the ones that stopped a heavy haul truck going through their reservation. It was going up to the same line that you guys' stuff was going through, but only it came through the Port of Houston. And they had actually got an agreement with the governor of South Dakota to go through the Ogallala Sioux Reservation in South Dakota without their knowledge. And these guys saw it, and they stopped the vehicles and told them they were trespassing and that they need to get off the reservation. And basically, they're threatening the people that were stopping them that they're going to be, they wanted them charged with kidnapping, and the FBI was actually on their way to charge them with kidnapping, and they're like, "No, you're free to go. You can go anytime you want. The trucks are staying here." The State Patrol, the South Dakota State Patrol, would not cross the boundary to even come try to help them because they knew that there were sovereignty issues there too. So, but it was the governor of South Dakota that just came out blatantly and just said, "You know, I can tell them they can go across anywhere they want." And basically, what the reason of it was, it was saving the trucking companies $50,000 per load to go through the reservation rather than going through the state checkpoints and having to pay the $50,000 fees. So, which is kind of weird that the state patrol would then be escorting them across the state of South Dakota after they left the reservation. But yeah, there's stuff like that going on.
So can we ask you a little more, Marty, about like what's going on now since that first standoff, which happened right near some of our final actions here in Moscow to stop the megaloads? You know, has there been any more trucks that have tried to go across the Sioux Reservation at this point?
No. There hasn't been any more, and the Tribal Council has actually gone to meet with the governor, and it sounds like they're not going to be doing that anymore. And even the truck drivers, during that time when they were in that standoff, truck drivers were calling the main company and telling them, "You guys need to find a different route. This is not going to work." So they made the point, and hopefully they'll have to find another route. But yeah, that's our problem with big oil. They can kind of buy their way through anything.
Yeah, we sure saw that here, and we wished we had as much success as those folks had defending their land. But tell us what else is going on, too, Marty, please.
Well, there's other things going on. You know, right now we have the new application in for the Keystone XL pipeline. That's the northern portion. That's from Montana down to just inside Lincoln, inside Nebraska border, the southern portion of the border. And what they're trying to do is put in a 36-inch pipe that's going to haul Canadian tar sands oil down through there. The biggest thing that stopped them before, I think, was probably the Nebraska that made the most noise, and that was with the Ogallala Aquifer and the Sand Hills. This time around, they're changing the route. They're still going through the Sand Hills, and they're still going over the Ogallala Aquifer, you know, they're making it look like they're the good guys here all of a sudden, but there's still great resistance in that area. When you talk about indigenous rights issues, then you get into the Ogallala, the Rosebud, the entire Lakota Nation in South Dakota, basically, is that there's a 1854 treaty, Laramie that basically gives them treaty rights from North Dakota border, Montana border, all the way down into Nebraska, and basically half of South Dakota is their treaty rights. And the Lakotas say that that is still on record because they never took the money. So what they're saying is that even the Black Hills, which is under in the treaty right area, is still technically theirs. And that everything else there does belong to the tribe. They have not ratified it by taking the money, so that is their stand right now. With that, then, Ogallala and everyone else like that right now also have a water pipeline going through the reservation from the Missouri River down to the southwestern part of the state, where the Ogallala and the Rosebud reservations are, and, you know, the Black Hills and the Badlands and stuff like that in South Dakota. And the reason they have to have this water pipeline there is because it needs to bring the fresh water to the reservations and the surrounding communities. It actually serves, I believe, 2 million people in that region. No, wait, not 2 million. 200,000 people in that region of the state with fresh drinking water, because the rest of the water in that area is contaminated from the uranium mining that they've done there. So they actually need this water pumped into their reservations and the surrounding communities for their only way of fresh water. The Keystone XL pipeline is going to cross this pipeline 2 times. And so what the tribes are saying is that they don't want to cross the pipes. The oil will be corrosive to their plastic pipes that are, or PVC pipes that are bringing the water down to the reservations from the Missouri River, and that if there's 1 in a million chance of them ever contaminating their water system, that would be the death of all those people, because they will no longer have fresh water. So that's important for us right now. With that, then also with the Keystone XL pipeline now, there's a process that has to go through. It's called consultation with the tribes. And they need to design a programming agreement. We're trying to push the tribes to say is that we want to be a signatory on that agreement. And if they refuse to sign for any reason, that agreement is then void and the pipeline cannot go through. So we're trying to get them to be signatories on there. The last time they're only concurs, and just basically concurs are only saying that, you know, we've read it and we agree to it, and that by agreeing to it or concurring to it, we can get money from TransCanada to put monitors out on the line so that if artifacts are found, that we have the right to take care of the remains and stuff like that the way we need to. So it's kind of a blackmail type situation. Is you need to sign this in order to get money to have monitors out on the line, and if you don't, then you don't have monitors out on the line. We'll just go through wherever we want to, and it doesn't matter. If we do find bodies, we'll just bury them, and we'll just keep on going. We'll never tell anybody. So yeah, that's kind of what we're going on right now.
Wow, and I'm sure that's slowing down the permitting, as well it should, of a project that should never, ever really happen. We've been curious because we've been so focused, of course, on trying to stop tar sands infrastructure building up as best as we can in the streets. What if you could lend some words about what might be happening up in Canada in terms of protests against the Enbridge, or I guess not Enbridge, the Northern Gateway pipeline that's heading out to the Pacific coast. And then I know there's been demonstrations even like in front of the main state houses up there as well, of Indigenous folks proclaiming their rights, as everyone should, to clean water and air and sovereignty and all of that. So can you fill us in a little about what's been going on up in Canada with those kind of protests recently?
The protests that have been going on, yeah, they've been all over. You know, they were just doing some protests out in Ottawa on the Parliament steps. But the biggest area where they're really pushing it is out in British Columbia. And the tribes out there are all united and standing together and saying that you're not going through our reservations, you're not going through our homelands, you're not going through our treaty areas. They've actually gone out and put houses and built houses all along the proposed route, because that's one of the deals of saying that if there's housing out there, those people own the land, and so the pipeline wouldn't be able to go through that area. So they're doing different things like that. This is going over the mountain range where the Northern Gateway is. So, you know, the tribes are very adamant and saying these are sacred for us. We need to, and they're just basically saying our treaty rights say that we have the right, we have the inherent right here. And they've given them feathers. They've given them three different feathers to the Enbridge officials, basically telling them after the third one is that they're no longer welcome. Each one is basically telling them to stay off their land. And after the third one, it's pretty much, we're done negotiating. We're done talking to you. You're not allowed on our land anymore. So they've done a lot up there as far as traditional-wise. You still have Fort Chipewyan and stuff like that downstream from the tar sands that are still have the polluted water. You have the tribes even further up now going towards the Arctic Ocean that are starting to see the effects of the water being contaminated, the deformed fish and everything else like that. So, it's kind of sad up there. You know, we're taught that if when we make decisions, we're supposed to think of seven generations out. That's about 150 years is what they kind of average that out to be. And, 150 years from now, we're not going to have oil. We're not going to have any of this. Tar sands are all going to be gone if they're allowed to continue to do this. But the tar sands tailing ponds in 150 years will still be there. They're right now 77 square miles large and 300 feet deep. So, I mean, it's going to take forever for them to ever dry up and do what they're supposed to do. But as of right now, the calculations say that those tailing ponds will still be there in 150 years.
Yeah, and that's a very difficult situation for people that are still so closely relying on the land and all of it maintaining its full integrity so they can maintain their lives and their lifestyles. And ironically, too, that whole area just downstream from the tar sands is still one of the richest, purest areas in the whole world in terms of water and wildlife and just the life of the place. So, yeah, how would you suggest, Marty, that people support indigenous folks, all over this continent in our shared fight against these dirty energy projects that are just going to ruin places forever?
Well, there's going to be things coming up. The Indigenous Environmental Network website, IENEarth.org, has lots of information as far as what IEN does, and we work with tribes north and south of the border in regards to the tar sands. Anything that we do, we normally post up there. That's the best way. But, I mean, right now we're still fighting, doing a lot of different things. We're going to AGM meetings. We're going, we're fighting reversal of pipelines. The southern portion of the United States, there's a thing called, it's the southern portion of the Keystone XL pipeline. And they are going through the Caddo Nation. And Julie Clafford down in Texas is a landowner who's going through eminent domain court. And she's right on the Red River that separates Oklahoma and Texas. And that is the normal Caddo Nation's historical trading grounds. And so there's all sorts of artifacts there. And the site is actually very well known. It's called the Sander Site. It was discovered in 1931, and there's actually been books published on it to tell you how important the site is. And the Keystone XL pipeline is due to go right through the middle of this. And it's not being protected. And basically what they'll say is that if there's artifacts found, people can get them and stuff like that, but if there's any remains found, they'll stop the pipeline and they'll go to a class 2 dig to see how many bones are there and everything else like that. But the problem with class 2 digs is that once a class 2 dig is organized and ordered, they've been disturbed, the bodies have been disturbed, and according to the federal laws and everything else like that and archaeological digging, is that those bodies are to be removed out of their sites and placed to whichever historical domain rights, the property value, or the property rights of those landowners. But yet you have the Republican candidate, Mitt Romney, saying that day one of his, if he gets to be president on day one, he's going to approve the Keystone XL pipeline. This is the Republican candidate again. So, I mean, even the extreme right hand of the Tea Party is saying no to this for what it's doing to the property rights. But yet, you have the presidential candidate saying, oh, we're going to run through it anyways. So, it's going to be an interesting campaign down there for a while.
Yeah, it seems like this next, at least national presidential campaign is going to be heavily influenced by the dirty energy companies like big oil, coal, and natural gas throwing their money around. It's the first big presidential election since the Citizens United decision said that money equals free speech. And so, yeah, a lot of us are really worried that these companies are just going to go ahead and trash everything, including the places where, you know, people should be left to rest in their home of the earth. It's a mess. And we are just so, so very proud and privileged that that Native folks all across this country in many places are leading the fight against these terrible corporations. And we're inspired by that, quite frankly. So that's why I'm so curious about all the news from the different places and about those fights. So is there any place or people that we're missing? I'm sure there's tons to talk about what's going on with that.
Well, even another thing that no one actually knows about, but in the Enbridge pipeline that went through northern Minnesota, the Alberta Clipper pipeline, they're now trying to increase that from the 460,000 barrels a day of oil that they're putting through it. They're trying to increase it to another 120,000 barrels per day. But with that, there are six pipelines that go through northern Minnesota. Some of them are crude oil, sweet crude oil, traditional oil. Others of them are traditional or straight-up tar sands oil. And what the problem is that some of these pipelines have been in the ground in Minnesota since 1949. So they're 60-something years old already, and these pipelines are still in use. But the big issue is that they went through Red Lake Reservation ceded lands unknowingly for the last 60 years, and they still do not have a contract with the reservation. The reservation has actually told them to get off the reservation, and that they don't want any money from them, but they want them off the reservation lands. So, there could be a showdown coming up in northern Minnesota, even with the Red Lake Reservation. And Red Lake Reservation is very unique in that state law does not supersede any law on the reservation. Matter of fact, state law does not even come into effect on the reservation, Red Lake Reservation. It's a sovereign nation. So it's only governed by federal government and by tribal code. So basically, if the Red Lake courts and the tribal council were to get an injunction and tell them you need to cease and desist and this court order is in place, they'd have to abide by it and they'd have to shut down the pipelines, all six of them, until they actually move them off the reservation. So I think there's something to be said here coming up yet. And so I'm still working with them and trying to push them to do that and make the pipeline companies jump and do what they say instead of the pipeline companies always coming through and telling the governments what they will do. So it's going to be a unique situation, and I hope that sometime here in the very near future it's going to per se blow up in their faces, and the tribes will prevail on this one.
So, Marty, we're curious because you were here in February 2011, and you helped mobilize some of the Nez Perce folks against the megaloads that are, of course, pieces of tar sands equipment heading up to Alberta. We have worked a little here and there with various tribes, other tribes besides the Nez Perce, although we've been working with them probably most extensively, where this tar sands equipment goes across their lands on state roads and such. And we're wondering if you could give us a little advice about how folks can work best to stop these transportation projects when they go across lands like the Coeur d'Alene People's Place and the Spokane people and such. You know, how can people stop these transportation ventures, especially if they're tribal people?
Well, I think they have some unique rights there. But obviously the state and the federal governments are going to say we supersede what the tribal law says. I would think that they would be able to use Department of Interior, Department of Transportation. They're going to say, what the governments are going to say is that this is federal highway, and the tribe has no say in it. And that's, realistically, I don't think is right. Because if there was a spill, just like when there's an oil spill, tanker spill in on the road going up between Lewiston to Missoula, when that diesel truck spilled over, it was actually the Coeur d'Alene Reservation that was in charge of the cleanup, because it happened within the boundaries of the reservation.
Oh, you probably mean maybe the Nez Perce tribe, because it's inside their reservation, or?
Right, the Nez Perce tribe was in charge of that cleanup, and to supervise that cleanup. So it's kind of unique in that the tribes are responsible for making sure that, and they're given the responsibility to make sure the cleanup happens, but they're not given the responsibility and the right to actually say no to the things going through the reservation in the first place. And they say they don't have a right to that. And they don't have a say in it to say yes or no to it. So we'll acknowledge you on this one, but we're not going to acknowledge you on this part type of a deal. And that's kind of what the way the government has worked with the tribes in its history. So that would be, I would think that the tribes should enforce and voice out even more and say no, because if this is a cleanup, if it spills, we are in charge of the cleanup and superseding and overseeing the cleanup of this. So we should have a say in this also. And, they should be able to say no to this, because it could have a little accident and damage their lands and contaminate their lands, like that diesel spill did down in the Nez Perce lands.
So do you have any parting thoughts for us, Marty, since we're going to be heading into another program here in about, a couple minutes?
I would say keep up the good work, you guys. Helen, I've loved watching what you've been doing out there, all of you guys. And it's been an honor for me to work with you guys, to know you guys, to come out and share in all the fun times that we've had out there in Lewiston and in Moscow. And, you guys did a damn good fight to go through, to stopping and going up the river and making them actually change their minds. And unfortunately, we didn't stop them going up through Moscow or going through up on the interstate and stuff like that. But I still take that as a victory for us. And I think that you guys should all take that as it was a small victory. But we did it, and it was an honor for you to work with you guys.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Marty. And we can't wait till you're back in our neck of the woods. And we have vowed to, fight this tar sands infrastructure buildup using our roads, no matter where it occurs. So hopefully it's just a matter of time before we scare them off all the roads in the Northwest. But thanks for joining us, Marty. And again, we hope to hear and see from you soon.
All right. We'll talk to you later,
Helen. Take care, Marty. So we have a few more announcements here that we missed previously, and that is that we still need to do a PSA, and we want to tell you about a native prairie plant sale. It's happening this Saturday, May 26th, The White Pine Chapter of the Idaho Native Plant Society is holding its first annual plant sale this Saturday, May 26th, 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. Almost all native, or all the plants sold at this sale are native to the Palouse Prairie or Moscow Mountain environment. Once established, they require minimal care. Many of these plants attract and support native butterflies, bees, and birds. We will have a variety of perennials, flowering forbs, some grasses, and a few shrubs. There will also be some woodland native plants, which typically grow in partial shade. Come early for the best selection. INPS, that's Idaho Native Plant Society, members will also be on hand to answer questions. We appreciate the donations and support from Pleasant Hill Farms, Thorn Creek Native Seed Farm, Cricket's Wildfire Flower Garden, Bruised Books, Trish Heekin, and Fiddler's Ridge. Please join us at the 1912 Center Arts Room upstairs at 412 East 3rd Street in Moscow between Adams and Van Buren Streets. We can only accept checks or cash. Please bring a box to transport plants. And there will also be an Oriental rug sale at the 1912 Center starting at 10 p.m. For more information, you can visit the White Pine Chapter website, whitepineinps.org, and a plant list is available on the website. After a few notes from our sponsoring organizations here at the radio station, we go now, after the Climate Justice Forum, hosted by Wild Idaho Rising Tide, to the radio program Occupy Wall Street.